The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, August 8th, 2008, and this is episode number 140. Today we have a really good show, a little bit different. Jules is taking the week off. We did a call with Darren Carpenter. He's a racer up in the OMRA series, Oregon Motorcycle Road Racing Association up there in Portland. And we did our long talked about show where we talk about the Daytona Motorsports Group takeover of the AMA road racing, along with most of the other AMA racing properties. So we sort of discussed that. We talked about track days, of course, because we can't resist. A little bit about MotoGP, just kind of all over the map, having a good time in conversation. I think you'll have a good time listening to it. Before we get to that, let's see. Got to send a big shout-out thank you to Michael and Peter Lentz for a donation to MotoGP OD. I really do appreciate that. Thank you very much. If you haven't heard of Peter Lentz, he is an 11-year-old phenomenon in the road racing circuit. He is pretty much cleaning up all the series that he races in. He's racing on NSR50s, RSF150Rs, that sort of thing. He's going to be moving up to a 125cc motorcycle here later this year, presumably for next season. He's been featured on Cycle News, Road Racer X. He had an interview on the Pit Pass Radio podcast a little while ago. You know, this guy's an up-and-comer. So 11 years old, super good motorcycle racer. Watching this video on YouTube is, well, frankly, it's a little discouraging because he's extraordinarily good, and it makes me feel very inadequate. So good for you, Peter. Do appreciate it, and good luck out there, and keep it up. We want to hear more about you in the future. So let's see. Other than that, another thing I want to mention is that Martin Darlington, a listener in the United Kingdom, England, that we've dealt with several times before. Martin's a good guy. And he sent us an email. And among other things, one of the things that he mentioned is that he wrote a letter. Now, did he do an actual letter or did he send an email? I'm not 100% sure. I think he actually sent a letter. But in any case, whatever it is, he sent a letter to the BBC asking them to consider that they bring over Toby Moody, Julian Ryder, and Randy Mamola in place of their current team of Steve Parrish, Charlie Cox, and Susie Perry. What's interesting about this letter, because, I mean, these are a very good idea. If you, over there in the United Kingdom, like watching MotoGP on Eurosport, and that you are as disappointed as the rest of us that to hear that Eurosport is no longer going to be broadcasting it, and the commentary team of Toby Moody and Julian Ryder and Randy Mamola will no longer be heard. If you're disappointed about that, and you're a legitimate BBC viewer and all of that, I encourage you to contact them. Write them an email, write them a real live letter in the post, however it is, because what's interesting about Martin's letter is that he got a real live response. He did not get a sort of a canned, thank you very much, we appreciate your input, and, you know, we'll blah, blah, blah kind of a letter. He got a real letter. Somebody actually read this letter. Now, whether it's going to move on up the chain to the true powers that be in the BBC, who knows? But if they get enough letters from fans, it does make a difference. You can make a difference. This has happened throughout the history of television and radio. A letter writing campaign is a very, very powerful motivator, very powerful voice for the executives and whatnot that run these schedules and all of that. And, you know, we don't want to see Steve Parrish and Charlie Cox and Susie Perry, all of them out of job. We really don't. But we also don't want to see Toby Moody, Randy Mamola, and Julian Ryder have their team broken up, because they are, as you heard last week on our Pepsi Challenge of Commentary radio show or podcast that we did, it's the team is somewhat magical. So BBC is sort of the most likely place for them to land. And as Jules says, we don't want to see Toby Moody going to Formula One permanently, because that would just be a tragedy. Jules or Toby Moody belongs commentating MotoGP, and we need to find him a job. So I encourage you over there in the United Kingdom, write some letters, and it might help. It might very well help. So let's see. Other than that, I think that we're about there. We do have some very, very sad news to report. This was a little bit too late for last week's show. Mentioned it briefly in the call with Darren. But Craig Jones, running in the World Supersport Series, passed away from fatal injuries that he incurred in the World Supersport race at Brands Hatch. So our condolences go out to Craig Jones' family and to his partner and all of that, because this is a big, big tragedy, and it's unfortunate. But this is why we love the sport so much, is that we watch people that can do it better than we can, and they are literally risking their lives. And that, you know, let's face facts, that adds an element to the whole thing, the fact that the sport is so dangerous. If it was completely safe, like, you know, watching a guy playing a video game or something, it wouldn't have a lot of the same element. And I'm not saying, of course, that I want to see crashes or anything like that. I'm not that kind of race fan. But the fact that these guys are doing something that, frankly, I'm afraid to do is part of the appeal for me. So it's unfortunate that occasionally things like this happen. So rest in peace, Craig Jones. Good on you, mate. You were a real example to us all, and you will be missed. So, all right, that sad note behind us, I think that about covers it. We had a whole bunch of other good emails this week. As usual, I'm a little bit behind. I know you guys all love to hear how much I'm behind on my standard email stuff. But in any case, let's get on with the show. Let's go ahead and listen to that call with Darren. All right, we got Darren Carpenter on the phone today. Darren Carpenter, as you will remember, is a racer in OMRA up there in Portland. Been on the show a couple of times. Hi, how are you doing, Darren?
Good. How's it going, Bob?
It's going good. Thank you very much. Having a good time. And this is our long-threatened, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that Darren and I have talked that we need to talk about AMA. So, among other things, we're going to talk about AMA today. And probably a little bit about track days, and we're just going to kind of see where it goes. So, what do we want to start off with, Darren? Do we want to jump right into the AMA stuff, or do we want to talk a little bit about MotoGP? I know you had some comments about Laguna Seca.
I know this has already been said, but I wanted to emphasize how big I think that race of Laguna Seca is going to be on the championship, you know, for the outcome of the season. And so, you know, like going into that race, Casey Stoner had won 3 races in a row. If he had won that race at Laguna Seca, he would have only been down by 15 points, and there would be 7 races left. So with only being down by 15 points, he'd only have to win 3 races, with Rossi finishing in second, to tie up the championship. And 3 races out of 7 races, I'm pretty sure he's got a pretty good chance of doing that.
Right.
And he would have, I think, gone into the summer break with the advantage, with the confidence, thinking, hey, this is going to be another year for me. But with Rossi winning that race, he's got a 25-point lead, which means Casey would have to win the 5 of the next 7 races, with Rossi coming in second in those races, in order for him to tie. 5 out of 7 is, you know, less of a chance than 3 out of 7. So I think it's going to make a really big deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's going to bring the championship closer to the wire. Now, one thing, and Jules and I mentioned this, is that, you know, we keep sort of forgetting about Pedrosa and to a certain extent, Lorenzo. Some of Lorenzo's comments, which you saw that. You heard it on the last show, right? Lorenzo's comments about lack of confidence might almost, in a, let's be perfectly honest and brutal, is going to somewhat take him out of the whole equation anyway. Unless he has some sort of miracle physical cure and mental cure for Bruno, he's not going to be in the game as much. But I think Pedrosa certainly will at some of these remaining tracks that we have.
Definitely. And something else is, it might be that, let's say Pedrosa has a, you know, doesn't do very well in the next two or three races. The Honda might give him the bike up, you know, for the next year, and kind of concede, hey, look, you know, we're not going to catch the first 2 places. We've got 3rd locked up. You might as well go out there and start getting some time on the new bike. You know, Nicky Hayden's on the new bike, and he seems to enjoy it. Their riding styles are different, so it's hard to say if Pedrosa would want to switch over to the new bike, or if he'd want to just keep working on the old one. But he's going to have to switch over eventually. So if he's kind of out of the points, and if he gets a better bike, it's a faster bike, it has maybe 5 to 10 more horsepower than the you know, Hayden's bike, the new generation bike, than the older generation. So he might play right into the last few races and get in the way of the championship.
Right. That's a real good point. Hadn't really thought of that, because we haven't heard anything as far as, you know, Pedrosa's kind of schedule to moving over to the pneumatic valve bike.
Yeah, and I think I was reading something today. It was on Road Racer magazine, and they were just saying how Pedrosa was still using the older bike, and he liked that bike. It, you know, it was basically built for him, and he's a smooth rider. You know, it's smooth everywhere. I think the complaint that Nicky Hayden has is that it doesn't have enough power, and it's also kind of too small for him. He doesn't feel comfortable on it, and you know, I think they made that bike for Pedrosa, so it's. You know, I'm sure he likes it a lot. It's hard to say if he'll do better or worse on the new bike. You would think they would always improve, but it is a different bike altogether. You know, the different characteristics of the motor and the chassis. You know, it's a new generation bike for Honda, so it's hard to say if you want to go to it or not.
Yeah. On that, on the size, I thought that the chassis was about the same, and that they were more or less shoehorning in the pneumatically valved engine with some, you know, minimal modifications, but not a big difference in size. Have you read otherwise, or?
I read in the article today, it said that they brought out the new motor, and put it in the old frame for Hayden to ride, I think, at Donington, and, that's the way it stayed, but I think they've got a new chassis for it now, too, and, I think... Laguna Seca and I'm not sure if they had it at Assen or where were they before Laguna Seca? Bruno?
Germany.
Yeah. Anyway, I think they do have a new chassis now. That in the article Hayden was saying he preferred the new chassis and the new motor. It was working great.
Hmm, okay. Okay. Wow. Interesting. Well, yeah, so that is definitely going to – Pedrosa is going to be a player in the last several races. We can't just discount him. You know, Laguna Seca was somewhat of an anomaly with his injury and all of that, you know, that just simply, you know, couldn't ride. I mean, that must have been a very, very difficult decision to make, like Jules and I were saying, and it just took him out of the mix. But I do think he'll be somewhat, somehow, some way in the mix at many of our future races here. So, it is. The championship is still pretty much, you know, relatively speaking, wide open. You know, with 7 rounds left. And like Jules and I talked, there's advantage Ducati, advantage Yamaha / Honda, you know, at these various different tracks. It's going to be good stuff.
I think so. But I think with that win at Laguna Seca, Rossi has really kind of given himself a nice cushion. It's not overcomeable at all, but it's much better and has, I think, a much more of an impact on the championship than if he had lost the race. If he had lost the race and Stoner was down by 15, you'd basically call that a tie going into the summer break.
Right. That's a good point. So it is. It's advantage Rossi. Yeah. On that, the whole Stoner-Rossi battle continues to heat up with stories in the Spanish press of Stoner, basically continuing to sort of harp on the you know, that Rossi's passes were unfair, and that I feel that I've lost respect for Valentino Rossi. And judging from the email that I've received and the comments that I'm reading on the websites and things like this, I am getting a bit of a mix of, you know, hey, put yourself in Stoner's position versus, yeah, you know, Stoner's a big whiner. But it does seem a little bit overwhelmingly in the Stoner's a big whiner category. And I'm not necessarily saying that's my position. But what do you think as a racer, as watching those passes? You've seen the race, I'm sure, you know, at least once. You've probably watched it a couple of times. What would you think of those passes if people were doing that on you? Like, particularly, say, the outside pass turn 3 on our on the famous lap 24 there.
Well, I have watched that race more than once. I think I watched it 3 times within the first 4 hours that it was on. It was an awesome race. But
every time I've watched it, I've been on the edge of my seat.
Yeah. I don't think that, you know, I think that was, you know, that was racing. I think... I don't really critique or put down Stoner for his complaining. You know, he's a racer. He's competitive. The media is there for a reason to blow these things out of proportion. And, you know, every time he sits down in front of the media, they're going to ask him the same questions over and over again. And he's probably the kind of guy that's just like, look, I'm going to tell you what I think, you know, to a point. And every time they've asked him, did he think that was safe? He's been like, no, I don't think it was safe at all. And, you know, and whatever, be it him moaning or crying, he doesn't, you know, he's a young guy, he'll learn how to deal with the press as he gets older. And, you know, the difference between Rossi is he's always been kind of the joker and kind of laughs at things and has a fun time with it. And Stoner's more of a serious, you know, I got a job to do kind of person. So, you know, I don't really fault him for that. I don't think any of those passes were at all, you know, out of line. That's just part of racing, and that's one of the things that Rossi has way more experience at and is just better at, is actually dealing and battling with people on the track. You know, he's done it in the reverse situation where he's been the faster guy, and he's just pressured when he was doing it to Sete and doing it with Max Biaggi, you know, pressured from behind and forced him into making mistakes. And I think he went into this race, he, you know, there's been a few times this year where he's tried to put pressure from behind on Stoner and on Pedrosa. Pedrosa doesn't really have that same kind of, but he's not going to crash based on pressure, you know. So I don't think he's, you know, he's not, that's not as effective. So he has to do something different, which is get in front and just make it hard and difficult to get around. And, you know, he's using all the track, and it's there all to use. So I don't see anything wrong with what he did at all.
Okay. And that's kind of what I was getting at, was as a guy that's actually gone out there and truly raced, you know, because, you know, I've done my track days and all that sort of thing, but that's miles, light years different. And just being, you know, an armchair quarterback fan the next day and watching this. And I agree, too, that Stoner's comments are, I think they're being somewhat blown out of proportion, you know, even including on this show, that he might be working the press in his own way, but I think your comment about that, you know, the people ask him the same questions and so he gives them the same answers, this has been a frustration of Stoner's in the past, that he doesn't like doing the press game. He doesn't like having the same dumb questions over and over and over again and all of that. And my point is that for him, and that's all well and good. You know, you can do that. You can be a top level racer and be a, I don't know, a curmudgeon or whatever you want to call it. But when Stoner then at Donington sort of made some comments about, you know, I don't know what it's going to take to get you people to like me along those sort of lines, it's like, you know, what it's going to take is for you to work the press and become likable. And so it's, you got to pick one position or the other, Casey. You either have to, you know, work the press and become, you know, the Valentino Rossi, the Nicky Hayden, the Colin Edwards, you know, the guys that can make the press work for them, or you can say, I'm not going to bother and be the, you know, the McDoin, the Kimi Raikkonen, you know, those guys.
Right.
You know, so that's just my point.
No, but, I agree.
Well, yeah. Well, all right. And one other thing I did want to point out about MotoGP, before we go too long and just having this call all about MotoGP, but which is always entertaining. As you may and probably have all heard, and Darren has definitely heard about it, I've heard about it, we had a rider, unfortunate accident in World Super Sport. Craig Jones, British rider, tragic crash, head injuries, died the next day. So we've lost a rider. That's not good. And I almost wonder that. And you remember in 2003 at Motegi, and Makoto Tomita made a pass on Sete Gibernau that forced Sete wide, and Sete went off into the gravel, and Tomita got spanked and was actually DQ'd from the race. So he lost his third place finish, and Nicky Hayden, who had finished fourth in, you know, actually crossing the line, was credited with third. And there's also John Hopkins was disqualified in that same race for, I don't remember the exact details, but in effect causing Troy Bayliss to crash at that same race. And he wasn't disqualified, but he was assessed a penalty for the next race.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, 2003 was awfully close to when Daijiro Kato died at Suzuka. If this sort of brings it to the top of the whole strict adherence to, you know, rules and things like this, and that some of Rossi's moves, maybe they were a little questionable at Laguna Seca, and had we just had an accident of this nature where a rider dies, would then, in that case, Valentino Rossi have gotten his hand slapped or not? Because my point has been, and I mentioned this on the show, that I think Valentino Rossi is likely to get away with some stuff that other racers would not, simply because he's Valentino Rossi. So, you know, not going back to the argument of whether any of these passes were kind of quote-unquote dirty or anything like that, but even if they were a little borderline, I think that the race direction might turn a bit of a blind eye to it because it's Valentino Rossi. But now that we've had a fatal accident in another FIM sanctioned series, does this mean that now we're going to possibly see a little bit more, like I said, a little bit more strict adherence to some of these rules? I mean, and what do you kind of think about that one?
Well, I think the point that Rossi's been around for a long time does give him more of the benefit of the doubt when it comes to, you know, anything on the track. I mean, Dorner's not going to penalize Rossi without a really good reason. But I think they probably would do the same for, maybe not as much, but for Danny Pedrosa or Casey Stoner, the guys that are at the front of the pack and, you know, getting wins. I think in those situations with John Hopkins and the other guy that got penalized, you know, that's further down the line, and, you know, I think they want to try to tell people, look, you know, if you're going to be fighting for fifth place position, then you're not going to be doing crazy things. But I don't think anything that Rossi did at Laguna Seca was even questionable at all. So, you know, I don't, you know, question whether he should have been penalized or not. I don't think any of those things he did was questionable, and I hope not. I mean, both of those penalties in the past, I thought were wrong penalties as well. So
the Tomato one certainly was, I think. I have to admit, I don't recall the details on the Hopkins penalty, but the Tomato one was, I thought, yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand. I mean, they're out there trying to go as fast as they can. All those riders know that if they're going to be spending time trying to run somebody off the track, that's going to cost them time on the track. And, you know, I don't think any of those guys are purposely trying to go out there and hurt somebody. You know, you'll see them waving fists at each other on qualifying sessions. But, you know, during the race, I think if somebody is trying to purposely take somebody out, it would be pretty obvious. And in those situations, it does need to be dealt with. But I've never seen that at the MotoGP level.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be a bit surprised. I think that these guys are basically, they're all more of a class act than that sort of a thing. I mean, that's pretty lame. One other thing is that I thought, and I'm just going to throw this out there because I've been intending to mention this in the last two shows. And as far as I recall, I don't think I mentioned it. But I was very disappointed when I was sitting there in the grandstands because when Stoner went down and dropped the bike there at Laguna Seca and it came up on the feed, there was cheering in the grandstand section that I was in. And I don't think that's cool at all as a fan. You know, and this is from the fan point of view. You know, you can cheer for your guy when he passes the other guy. Oh, yeah, all day long. But you don't cheer when someone drops his motorcycle. That's not cool.
Yeah, I'm surprised, and especially being that this was Laguna Seca. I mean, this is not like it's in Italy or in Australia.
Oh, the crowd, at least certainly surrounding me, were very, very clearly Rossi fans, much more than Stoner fans. And, I mean, because, you know, the level of cheering and all that, every time Rossi would get back in front of Stoner, yay, you know, and all that sort of thing. But I was a little disheartened and surprised that people actually cheered when Stoner went down, and I thought that was kind of crap, to be honest with you. So
yeah, it is crap. But,
yeah,
I think when you get a bunch of people together, the intelligence kind of goes down to the weakest.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So, all right, let's move on. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about AMA and what we've got going on with the whole DMG AMA Superbike mess, frankly.
So maybe we should give a little bit of background for your international listeners or people who maybe are only MotoGP fans, because they're probably thinking DMG and AMA and what is that and why do I care?
Indeed. Why don't we do that? And if you'd like to lead it off, I feel a little confused right now about the rules, but I don't think I'm alone because I think that most of the teams are quite confused and the factories themselves as well. And we'll get into that in a second too. But where are we at right now, Darren?
Well, first, to give your listeners just a little bit of background, I did a little bit of research on the Daytona Motor Group, and you know, it's people need to understand where they come from. You know, so I don't know if maybe it will give us an idea of what they're going to do with the AMA, but the Daytona Motor Group is in charge of NASCAR for the most part. It's a family-run business. The guy that started it back in the 30s or 40s, and they just wanted to put on racing for the entertainment value. There was no aspect at all of performance vehicles or making cars go better. It was all about, let's just get some of our buddies together and have close racing. I'm not even sure if close racing was what they wanted, but entertaining racing is what they wanted. And so they started this stock, you know, spec series. It was basically stock street cars. I think in the beginning they couldn't change anything on the car. Like, it was a car basically rolled off the showroom floor. There was, I think, a race in the very beginning where somebody, like, put some wedges in the springs to help make the, you know, suspension stiffer, and they got disqualified for even doing something like that. So they couldn't make any changes at all to the cars. As, you know, racing kind of progressed, they started getting away from that and started allowing more and more changes. But they've done several things with NASCAR, all with the intention of keeping it, you know, entertainment value, that you kind of question whether it's the right move or not. And it's easy to bash NASCAR because, as a motorcycle fan, and most people who are MotoGP fans, like the technology edge of it, like the fact that they're pushing the edge and trying to go faster. It doesn't make sense of not, you know, for NASCAR to not do that. It's like they purposely put rules into effect to make the car slower. And when there's a technology that comes out that kind of increases performance, they a lot of times outlaw it. So it's kind of a strange group.
Yes. Yeah, I have a lot of my own views about NASCAR, but I don't want to go down that road too much.
No, and I don't think we need to. But, you know, they've come out, the previous owners of AMA Superbike, you know, or AMA, I should say, you know, they had their problems as well, and they just didn't really know how to market the AMA. You know, the motorcycle racing here in America, the National Series, is not, I don't put it on the same level as some of the other series, you know, in Britain or in Europe. But, you know, it just seems like they don't have a real strong following of race, you know, fans for the AMA. It doesn't really get prime time, you know, coverage. The tracks they go to are really not, they're just kind of these oval tracks. You know, a lot of them are just regular oval tracks, but they have an infield section that they'll put in. So the tracks really aren't that top quality either. So there's definitely some problems with AMA.
Right. I don't think anybody's going to argue that one.
Right. So the Daytona Motor Group came out and they bought the, you know, the rights for the AMA Superbike and AMA in general. And they've just kind of been, you know, they've put out a few releases as far as what they're planning on doing that have a lot of people questioning, like, what is going on. And they haven't been real clear. And a lot of stuff they've kind of just put out and not really, you know, it's just so off the wall. You're like, what are they thinking? So, you know, a lot of it is, you know, we haven't gotten much. We've gotten some information in the last few weeks, some press releases that we can talk about. But up until now, it's just been kind of, you know, we're not really sure what they're going to do. What they say they're going to do doesn't sound like even in the realm of possibilities, and none of the manufacturers are happy. None of the factory teams are happy, and rightfully so. If you figure your factory Suzuki, they've dominated the AMA Superbike Series. I think they've won the last 40 races in a row. And with the Daytona Motor Group's history, whenever a certain team has started to dominate, they'll quickly penalize that team to kind of bring them back into competition with everybody else. So if you're already an existing factory team, it's like you really don't have a desire to put much money into a system that's going to be built to penalize you right away. And that's the thing with Ben Spies trying to go to MotoGP. All of those factory riders are like, you know, if you're Ben Spies, you want to get out of AMA. And there's been rumors about him going to Suzuki, and just recently some of those rumors have kind of come back, like maybe that's not going to happen. And there's been rumors with him talking to Ducati. There's been rumors with him talking to World Superbike, the all-star Suzuki team. You know, so I think he's just fishing to get out of AMA. And I think a lot of the big factory riders are doing the same thing.
Yeah, I agree. And the recent the problem that I've had with the whole Daytona Motorsports Group and all of that thing, initially when it first happened, I thought, well, you know, maybe this is a good thing. And then they came out with a sort of first draft of the rules, and it was pretty much a spec race, a lot of horsepower limit. You know, as long as the bike fits a certain horsepower to weight ratio, then, you know, you can race it and things like this. That was a little confusing. The latest draft, actually, if anything, leaves me even more confused. And I don't, like I said, I'm not alone. None of the factories have, I won't say none, but the Japanese factories certainly will not commit at this point. They're being extremely vague because frankly, it's a bit of a mishmash. Do you want to go down the latest iteration of the classes that we've got going on?
Yeah. So the press release that I'm looking at was dated the 21st of July. And they talk about three classes. And I actually, this press release actually has me feeling better than the last few releases I've seen, to be honest with you. Because I'm like, okay, this kind of makes sense to me. There's going to be a factory superbike class, an American superbike class, and a Daytona superbike class. So the first thing that I think when I read that is I'm like, you know, if I'm a non-fan, what's the difference between factory, American, and Daytona?
Right.
Which has been a problem, I think, with AMA now is when they have all these different classes, and if you're not a real fan, you just turn the TV on, you're not going to know the difference between these different bikes. They turn very similar to lap times. I mean, they're maybe a few seconds apart, but, you know, and in motorcycle racing, a few seconds is a huge distance, but the non-fan, they're not going to notice the difference.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption.
The way they break it down is factory superbike is going to be a new program. It's going to be, let me just read the release here, a new program from the constraints of attempts to balance the resources of factory teams to those of private entries. Featured are leader class sport bikes operating in the highest level of technology and performance. Brand calls for full implementation of the IFM World Superbike rules by 2011. But to ease the transition from the current equipment, 2009 factory superbikes will be prepared to the specifications agreed to in 2007 by AMA. So next year they're not going to make any changes to the AMA superbike. They'll just rename it factory superbike. But then eventually that'll push it by 2011 to have the same rules as the FIM World Superbike.
Which I've heard actually also that it seems like there's a bit of an assumption on the part of DMG that World Superbike is going to be doing a big rules change and that a lot of other people are sort of wondering where they're getting this idea.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, that was one thing I've been reading Cycle News this week. And it was pretty much along the lines, pretty much that, you know, simply put, that you know, the in World Supersport or World Superbike as well, the FIM and FG Sport, who are the promoters, make the rules, and the manufacturers don't have the same say that they have in MotoGP. But it doesn't seem like anybody's very dissatisfied with the rules as they are, so they were... and then the whole opinion piece of it was, if I recall correctly, was that Daytona Motorsports Group is sort of expecting these World Superbike rules to be dumbed down by 2011, and they were sort of wondering, you know, why they're thinking this. And then my other point about the factory superbike class, which it sounds great. It's like, you know, you got the top racers, non-control tire. You know, so you've got tire development and a fairly relatively loose set of rules as far as mods and all of that sort of thing are concerned. So this is like, you know, this is the pinnacle of motorsport, all that good stuff. And that's what we want to see. Except that in AMA, there's relatively, you know, I mean, there's only so many dollars to go around. So, and this is the problem right now with AMA Superbike, that it's primarily, it's a race between about, you know, like six guys. And then you fill the grid with a lot of guys that have absolutely no hope of keeping up with these guys because they're more or less riding a hopelessly outclassed motorcycle that conforms to the super stock rules. And they, in the new DMG rules of factory superbike, they're not going to allow you to come up and race your lesser motorcycle against these bad boys. And they want the manufacturers to all guarantee four bikes per manufacturer on the grid, and the manufacturers are kind of not too thrilled with that idea either.
Right, and that was my thought when I read this, was who's going to be in that race. Like you say, the way it is right now, AMA Superbike, you probably have the top 10 are factory, you know, or factory.
That's that.
I mean, you have Suzuki, which usually has, you know, three riders in the top 10, and then Honda, American Honda, has two riders in the top 10, and then you've got Kawasaki with two riders, and Yamaha with two riders. Ducati's not in AMA Superbike anymore, and really, those manufacturers have only been there for a few years. If you go back maybe 4 years ago, it was really just Honda and Suzuki.
Right.
So Kawasaki and Yamaha are new to the program, and so they haven't really caught up to Suzuki yet. They've been making gains, but you just can't come out the first year. And so in any case, it's like, well, Honda only has two riders now in factories in the AMA Superbike. They're going to have to guarantee four riders. And even if they did, it's going to be a grid of what, like, 16 bikes, 18, 20 bikes.
Not barring injuries, which puts you on the level of MotoGP and the problem they have with small grids. And that's, I really have my doubts about that whole plan.
I mean, I like the idea is a really good idea. And if they could get 30 bikes on the grid or 25 to 30 bikes on the grid, full factory supported teams, or even if it's like a Michael Jordan team. Michael Jordan is not a factory team, but he gets support from Suzuki just in maybe some technology and some bikes. But it's his own team. He doesn't have the funds to go up against a full factory bike in a full factory program, like, say, World Superbike.
No, correct. But he's like Michael Jordan's a little bit in a class of his own as far as the privateer sort of a thing going on, because, he's Michael Jordan. But, that at that tip-top level of privateer effort, you're getting close. But, yeah, you're still not quite there because, let's face it, the factory is the one that makes the motorcycle.
Right.
And, so they're not going to, when we say that a superbike is a factory, it's a production-based motorcycle, that can mean a lot of things. It can mean a motorcycle that was made on Friday afternoon by the assembly line where they're kind of thinking about going home and having, rice and sushi or whatever it is. Or it can mean one where it was hand-assembled by this team of, racing experts where they're getting to pick and choose through, like 400 pistons to find the four that they think are the best piston that's ever been made, that kind of thing. And you're going to get a different motorcycle.
Right. And plus, it is a production-based racing, like you say, but there are a lot of rules, are a lot of room to custom, build parts.
Correct.
The factory teams have the support, and, they can they have their own R&D. They can make up these parts. And that was one of the things I've read some interviews with Michael Jordan. He was saying that his frustration was that there's just certain things he cannot get. It's not a matter of it costing too much. It's just they're not available to him. The factory makes the part. They're not selling it. They're using it on their bike until next year. If it, seems successful, then they'll release it maybe to the general public. But, they're making parts for that bike.
And exactly. And that has been Jordan's problem all along, is that, no matter how much money you throw at it, it's simply not available.
Right.
But so that's the factory superbike. And that was, if I recall correctly, from the press release that you're reading, that was a new thing, right? That DMG had said this. Yeah. Because all these rules haven't even been finalized. It's August now. And, supposedly we're going to be starting a new season in only a few months. And you have teams and factories that don't have, the rule book. It's like, that's pretty hard to build a motorcycle when you don't have the time.
Well, and I think part of this release said that they are going to not make these changes effective till 2011. So they know they can't make these changes right away. They've already said that 2009 they've already agreed to go with the specifications that were in 2007.
On the superbike class. Factory superbike class. Okay. I might have missed that reading that portion. Okay.
I'm not a very good reader, so.
Let's move on to the American superbike thing, which like we were joking about, that it's all superbike, everything's superbike. So the American superbike is
The American superbike is the same machines, a liter class, but less modifications. There's going to be a spec tire. There's probably going to be a spec gas. Parts will have to be available to all competitors. Testing will be limited to reduce cost. This is the American Superbike class. So they say in here that you can run factory Superbike if you have a factory Superbike license, which is going to be restricted to, the factory teams, I guess. And in the American Superbike, you can run if you've got a factory Superbike license or an American Superbike license, which kind of lets you think that, like they do currently, there are some teams that run AMA Superbike, and then the same rider turns around and rides AMA, the Super Sport class, I believe, which is the 1,000, the leader class.
Super Sport is 600s.
Than the Super Stock.
Stock,
I guess.
Super Stock, yeah. There's a bit of a mix. Every factory seems to be doing something different, and that's part of the problem right now, is that,
right,
like, the best rider will be in this different class, because
right,
then is, yeah, and that's part of the problem they're trying to address.
So the AMA Superbike class, it's not really clear whether we're going to have the same problem there. I mean, is it going to be some of the factory teams are going to say, you know, we'd rather just run not even a factory team, quote-unquote, but we'll just have a strongly supported, American Superbike, you know, team.
Right, right. A sort of a factory privateer, almost, yeah.
Which is what Yamaha did up until a few years ago. They didn't have an AMA Superbike team. They did the 600 class, which is a super sport, and I think they even had a bike in the super...
Super Stock,
the class.
Yeah, they did
there as well, but they didn't run super.
It wasn't a true factory effort, right? And
right.
There's a lot of that going on in AMA. It's a bit of a it's now confusing, and it's just getting more confusing. And in effect, the American Superbike boils down to what we currently call here in the AMA Super Stock, and which is also the World Superstock Championship, which is, you know, it's a great idea. It's a great racing series. Let's go, you know, pretty much buy a motorcycle on the showroom floor, you know, take off the lights, put on some bodywork, minimal amount of modifications, you know, mostly like suspension. Yes, you can put on a new exhaust and some other areas here and there, but you're limited. And yes, it makes for good racing, but it's not quite world class.
Right, and the question goes just how much are the manufacturers going to want to support riders in that class? Because, you know, the manufacturers want to stand out, so they want to get the advantages, and as soon as you start doing spec tires, spec fuel, spec other things, they know that it's really up to the rider, and so what benefits to them are they going to have to, you know, put a lot of money into that class?
Exactly. Because it does boil down to race on Sunday, sell on Monday. And Suzuki, I'll tell you, they sell a lot of motorcycles over here in the United States. And of the GSX R1000 or the GSX R600, those motorcycles are very, very popular motorcycles. And I think that it's due in large part to their performance in AMA racing.
Well, it's that, and it's also just the commitment they've made to racing in America. You know, even when I first got started racing, if you were a good racer and you were going to buy a new bike to go racing, it's not just the bike you're considering, but it's the support that they'll give, even down to the club level. And Suzuki has always outperformed the other manufacturers as far as offering up contingency money. And because of that, a lot of local club races will go with Suzuki, and they've done that. Suzuki's done that all the way up through the national level, and that also provides a lot of aftermarket parts because people that make the aftermarket parts know that a lot of people race these bikes. So that whole kind of thing leads to just more sales on Monday, because if you're just an average street rider, if you know somebody who races at the club, they're probably on a Suzuki. If you watch TV, you're going to see AMA racing. You're going to see the Suzuki team out front. So I think it all kind of blends together.
Right. And I think that Suzuki has actually done a very good job, because this is, comparatively speaking, compared to Honda and Yamaha, Suzuki is a small company. And, you know, these guys are on that class, that you know, GSX R1000, you know, the leader bike and the 600cc class and all that. They're, you know, I don't have actual numbers here in front of me, but they're very, very dominant.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So the problem that we have so far, though, with American Superbike is that, have the rules even been finalized? I mean, I know we don't know what spec tire it's going to be. and we don't know what spec gas and all of that. Not that that's, you know, a huge, huge issue. But what about the other rules? I mean, do the teams, does like a relatively average, but, you know, a higher end privateer effort, like the Geico race team, Celtic Racing, you know, these guys, these aren't factory supported teams, but you know, there's some money there. Do they know what they're expected to do for the 2009 season?
Yeah, I don't think those things have been finalized.
No, and it's August.
We were talking to Brad Holkhalter, who's a friend of ours that works with AMA, does the scoring, works in the scoring and timing capacity. And he was just like, yeah, he's like, I think I have a job. I think they're going to be doing scoring. But other than that, there's just been a lot of information, and none of it's really been set in stone. You know, there hasn't been anything kind of signed, even to officially make them the actual, you know, ownership of AMA. So there's just a lot of things up in the air. And, you know, I would assume, and I'm probably assuming way too much, but I would assume that they'll kind of make 2009 just a continuation of 2008 with all the same rules, because of the fact that, like you say, you really can't prepare a team unless you know what the rules are. You know, and have some kind of a transitional period of a year or two before they kind of make everything official. But it doesn't seem like they're going to have the same classes, that's for sure. So if you're a Celtic Racing, you know, what kind of bike do you prepare? Do you prepare a 600? Do you prepare a 1000? You know, do you try to go, you know, sorry, you just can't say. I mean, unless it's a factory team, if you're going to try to race in the factory superbike class, you know the rules are going to be the same as the AMA superbike, but if you didn't have a bike in that class, maybe you raced in the super stock class, well, you know, what kind of bike do you need to build for that class now? And if you raced a 600, you know, where does that fit together? They've taken away the 600 super sport class, which is probably the most contested class out there, and they just have one now class for 600, which is the Daytona superbike class. And that one, it sounds like they're really going to be displacement, you know, weight to horsepower ratio, to the point where probably I can almost imagine after the race they pull the first three bikes and they put them on a dyno and they weigh them, and it has to fit within a horse, you know, weight to horsepower ratio.
Right, and there's also the rules like, I can't think of the actual term, but you know, where you can say I'm going to buy that guy's engine. Which is, I mean, this is fairground racing where you have that.
Right.
You know, those limits of, you know, this. We don't want this rich guy to spend so much money on his car, because there's the that challenge that it can occur at the end of the race of a, you know, you basically get to buy the other guy's motor for, you know, whatever it is, right? You
right.
Know, however many thousands of dollars. And to have that on a national series, I think is frankly ridiculous. But one... factor that they want with the Daytona, notice the word Daytona and the Daytona Superbike class, is that these are the motorcycles that they're going to have racing the Daytona 200. And the thing is the France family and Daytona Motorsports Group and all of that sort of stuff, they're very concerned about the tracks that they own and filling the seats, you know, during these big events. And like Daytona Bike Week, I don't know how many freaking thousands of people go there and do all the, you know, the cruises up and down the road and getting drunk and all of that.
Hundreds of thousands, I think.
Yeah, it's insane numbers of people. But the people that go to the race is a small fraction.
Like 10,000.
Yeah, exactly. A tiny fraction. And I think that the France family wants to get it where you can fill, or, you know, at least get closer to filling, these big, giant rovals. And you know, just get people in the seats, whether they know anything about sporty bikes or not, or what have you, you know, that's not the important part for them. The important part is, you know, butts in seats. And
right.
Yeah, that concerns me.
And I'm not sure how this Daytona Superbike class, my impression is I don't think it's going to be the same class that is now called Daytona.
No,
or the
I agree.
The Formula Extreme class.
No, it'll be quite different, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, what they really want is they want an American manufacturer to go out there and be able to be competitive. So they want, because this whole horsepower to weight ratio, one, they want more manufacturers in general. So you're looking at like Triumph and maybe BMW, KTM, possibly that kind of thing. But also Buell. You know, let's get Buell out there. Let's get out Buell out there where they can qualify at the front of the grid, finish a race, and actually maybe even be on the podium and all that sort of thing. And that's what they're looking for, I think, on that.
I think so. But it's also a class that I don't think any of the manufacturers are going to want to touch with a 10-foot pole.
Not the current manufacturers, no way.
Yeah, it's just going to be individual club racers that come out. And, you know, I'm not sure if they're going to have any kind of system in place where, like, to get an AMA, to work your way up in licenses, you first have to start off with one. You know, who knows? But it's not going to be manufacturers. It's basically going to be club racing. And I don't think any of the factory superbike or American superbike racers that are actually salaried racers are going to race in that Daytona superbike class. So again, I don't know what, and like you say, they want it to be competitive for the Buell. Well, the only way to make it competitive for the Buell is if you restrict the other.
If you cripple it.
And you know, just so people understand, that's one of the things that the Daytona Motor Group does with NASCAR. And an example of that is just recently, last year, so first of all, I want to throw this disclaimer out. It might sound like I know a lot about NASCAR, and people might assume I'm a NASCAR fan. I actually did research before this call. I talked to some people that I know, coworkers who are NASCAR fans, and I got all the dirt from them. So I'm just kind of regurgitating what they said. But Toyota started a NASCAR team last year, and everybody was like, oh, Toyota, they're just new to the game. They're not going to know how to do anything. It's going to be years before those cars are competitive. Well, this year, Toyota has, crushed the rest of the field. They're just, like, pulling away, and then they have these spec races, or they call them air restrictor races, because it really, you know, mutes everybody down to a certain horsepower. These Toyota cars are still pulling away from everybody. So Daytona Motor Group said, we're going to check these motors to see if they're cheating. They came out later and said they were not cheating. They built these motors, you know, within the rules, but we're still going to dock every Toyota racer 15 horsepower off their motor. Yeah.
That's quality. And, I mean, the thing is these ideas, these types of rules have their place, but their place is at your local fairgrounds, you know?
Right.
Where you just want to go out and watch a good race, and you don't want the local rich guy to spend more money than the other guy and all of that. And, I mean, those things make perfect sense. You know, I have no objection to spec racing. What I have an objection to is not just spec racing, but sort of created racing that you market as though it's the pinnacle of motorsport. And right. And this is the best thing ever, you know, and that's what I'm concerned about with the whole DMG takeover of AMA. Now, the more that I've read, the more that I've heard that this is what they're going to do.
Right. And some other things they released, the rain races.
Yeah.
Just so the international listeners, whoever they might be listening to this call, can understand the tracks that they use in America for the AMA national series. They're not top quality tracks. And some of the tracks we've called, what do you call them, a roval.
Roval, yeah, like it's a road course inside an oval, yeah.
And then some of the tracks are just, you know, they're just older tracks. They've got walls right along the sides of the track, and they're just not what you would consider quality tracks. A good example of that is in Europe, when they paint the curbing, they use a non-slick or a grip paint, they call it. In America, that paint probably costs about five times as much as a regular latex paint. But in America, they don't use it. They use just regular, you know, latex paint when they paint the curbing. Well, if you're racing in the dry, it's fine. But if it's wet at all, that's like grease. You know, you'll watch a MotoGP race. You'll see them up on that, you know, strip on the edge of the track, and they're doing fine, even in the rain. But in America, all club racers know you want to stay off anything that has any kind of paint on it because it's really slick. And so there's several tracks that AMA go-tos that the riders have said, we're not racing at these tracks in the rain. They're just not safe. And Daytona Motor Group came out with a release that said, there's no reason why we can't race at these tracks in the rain. We've put, you know, they've approved and, you know, done all of the safety improvements that we want them to do, and so they race in the rain in World Superbike, and in at MotoGP we're going to race in the rain. And so it just kind of gives you an idea that, you know, before it was kind of like a racing organization by committee. They would get input from the riders, they would get input from the tracks, they would get input from the organizers. And Daytona Motor Group is more of a situation where they're just like, we're in control, this is how it's going to be. So it's kind of a scary thing if the riders don't really have a lot of input on where they're going to race and the safety improvements that are required.
Yeah, and it makes you, like we talked about earlier, it makes you wonder how many riders are going to be jumping ship. I mean, I think they're going to be the top level of rider that can get a ride elsewhere. They're going to be out of here.
Right.
And the whole, the ironic thing is that you have, well, Roger Edmondson has been in charge of AMA before, but he was sort of pushed out. He's the guy that Daytona Motorsports Group has as the front man for this whole thing. But the Daytona Motorsports Group is passing down edicts like, you're going to race in the rain, you know, even at Mid-Ohio that you know, is not a very safe track, and all of these sort of things. When NASCAR, their prime market, what have you, races a 36 race calendar with two road races, and those two road races are the only ones that they would even consider doing in the rain, because when it rains, NASCAR shuts down. It's like baseball. But I don't know the last time that they actually did race at Watkins Glen or Laguna Seca when it was raining. From what I read, an article, and this was a couple of years ago, about NASCAR, that they, you know, they bring these rain tires out just in case it rains, but they haven't actually raced there for years. And there was some concern over, you know, well, these tires are pretty old. That's sort of a thing. And it's to have people, and I'm not trying to start a big NASCAR bashing session, but to have a corporation or whatever it is, an organization that has that attitude about racing in the rain, pass down edicts to motorcycle racers who have been out there on the tracks and know what they're talking about, that, you know, yeah, I don't care, you're going to race in the rain anyways. That seems a little ironic to me.
Right, and I mean, one of the arguments that you'll hear sometimes is that, let's say Mid-Ohio, which I think is the one track in question that the racers are like, there's no way, it's a sketchy track in the dry and in the wet, it would be unrealistic, it's just way too unsafe. And you'll hear local club racers that probably live in Ohio that race at that track, and they say, hey, I race in the rain all the time at this track, and it's not a problem, we do it all the time. And you know, the difference is the factory riders, you know, you, even if all the factory teams leave, they're going to be able to find 40 guys to race motorcycles around a track in this country. I'll go race AMA if they give me a chance, you know, I mean, that's just unsaid, and that's always the way it's going to be. When you've got riders who are trying to make it into the big races, they'll race anywhere just to get an opportunity to race in front of people. But the factory guys, this is their career. And so it's like, you know, we go much faster than any of the club racers. We're more on the edge of actual traction at all times than any of the club racers. This is something we do for a living. You know, if I get myself hurt, I'm out of a job, you know. Now, for the club racer, he's like, well, I get myself hurt, I'm done racing too. But it's like, well, you didn't really do that for a living to begin with.
That makes a lot of sense, because, I mean, even as it is now, AMA grids tend to be filled at the back by the local hot guy at that track.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, currently, AMA Superbike, you know, there's probably a total of, let's say, 25 to 30 bikes on the grid. The top, you know, there's 10 factory riders. There's probably about five, you know, factory-supported riders. So that leaves half the grid that's just, you know, club racers trying to, you know, one, kind of live a dream, or two, try to get noticed, or, you know, or just out there having fun, you know.
Right, anything. And especially the purse money. That's one other thing we've been talking about with Daytona Motorsports Group, is they're going to have a purse structure that pays, and I don't recall the exact figures and stuff, but once you start talking about farther down the grid or farther down the finishing order, you know, it's paying out money, a significant amount of money, to everybody that finishes the race.
Yeah, I did see something about that, but it wasn't enough money. Like, what I read, and this is just, it's been a while since I read it, so I could be completely wrong, and that's the other thing we've talked about already, is the information we've gotten from Daytona Motor Group hasn't really been in stone either. but it was like if you for the winner they got $50,000, and then from second place to 20th or 25th or something, it was $5,000 per person all the way down.
That sounds familiar, actually. Yeah.
And that seems like a lot of money, but I'm pretty sure that each one of those second through 20th place positions spent $5,000 that weekend racing. So it's not like they're making money. It's not like they can't have their day job anymore.
But if all else fails, you got a free racing weekend out of it, and you got to be on TV and all of that, which is going to appeal to a lot of people.
I mean, it's not even a free weekend. I mean, you have to understand, like, to get into AMA racing, let's just say one race weekend event, you have your transportation cost to get to, say, Mid-Ohio from Southern California. Then you're going to spend probably $3,000 or $4,000 on tires for that weekend, because if you're going to try to race at the top level, you need to put new tires on every session. It's no using some takeoffs from the last two races at AMA, at the AMA level. And you've got fuel costs. They're all using race fuel. Those things cost about, I think it's about $20 a gallon or more for the race fuel. So just the cost of the weekend is going to cost you about $5,000. That doesn't pay for the bike that you purchased in the very beginning of the year. That doesn't pay for all the modifications you had to do on the bike. That doesn't pay for your leathers. That doesn't pay for, all of the stuff that you had to do ahead of time. If you crash and your bike is totaled, so that $5,000 is really not a lot of money.
It's just a pittance, yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, I think that hopefully you're as confused as I am about the AMA, because I think it is a bit of a mishmash, and I think unless you had some other kind of points to make or something, Darren, maybe we should consider moving on here.
No, I think we're done bashing.
Yeah, it's
Daytona Motor Group.
It's in a state of flux, folks. That's all there is to it. And if you have some secret inside information, I'd be happy to hear it. One last thing we want to cover a little bit, though, Darren and I were talking about, is track days. We're all big track days. Darren and I have done a lot of track days together. Darren's the guy who sort of got me, invited me up to, hey, come do a track day and all of this, and sort of, was my mentor, if you will. And, we have a great time. We go up there, several guys, hanging around, and it's a good time.
Yeah, so there's a few things I wanted to talk about. Try to wrap this call up. We don't want to spend 2 hours like you and Jules do, but
we're at an hour already.
All right, I got the timer started. One was, you mentioned how your last track day you had to get off, went down last session of the day. Fergus, who also we've done some track days with, his last track day, he went down last session of the day, and. So I just wanted to mention how, I think people already know this, have done track days before, but it's that last session of the day. A lot of times you're just a little bit fatigued and you're a little bit tired. And when you get in that situation, it's just much harder to concentrate and focus, and you're much more likely to have a mistake somewhere, at some turn or some point that's just going to, cause you to go down. And it's a lot of times, it's not even, you get done with the whole thing and you sit up and you're like, oh, I know exactly what happened. I totally missed my braking marker, or I did, grab the too much brake or grab too much throttle. You know exactly what you did. And you're like, I can't believe I did that.
Yes, I agree. And I, the funny thing is, and unfortunately, the last track day that I did up there, you weren't there. It was Fergus and I went. And Fergus and I were talking right before the last session of the day about, you don't want to end the day on a bad note. And I can't remember exactly what brought it up, but I remember distinctly that sentence, let's not end the day on a bad note. And Fergus is riding in the A group or expert group or whatever it was, that particular organization. And I was in the B group. And so Fergus goes out and he does his stuff and he comes back and I go out and I'm riding my thing. And it wasn't very many laps into it on that last session. And I believe I've talked about this on a previous call or two, but basically I was pushing it a little, sort of like, I want to get in some, good laps for this last session. And I just went into the corner a little hot, kind of late, and somewhat missed my marker, I don't know exactly why. It was fatigue. And I could have been all right had I had more experience, because it was like, I need to lean this bike over farther. And I actually did. And it's like, well, I'm still not doing it, and I knew that. And then I hit what I thought was concrete right along the edge of the track, and it turned out to be sand. And that was the bummer thing. And, you know, had I known that was sand, but you you get a chance to walk the track. And I didn't do the drive around in the pickup truck. So when you're riding past it that fast, how are you going to know one way or the other if it's sand or concrete, unless you've actually, ridden on it? It is at that last part, you really have to be aware, because the following next track day that I wasn't at, Fergus had the same sort of issue going on. I don't know the full details of his, but it was last session.
Last session, hey, lost concentration. And that's, one of the things when I talk to people and I tell them how I race motorcycles, and sometimes we'll talk about the end of the day. When I come home on a Sunday after I've been racing all day, I'm just exhausted. I have no energy at all. It's almost as if I did I ran a marathon or something. And people don't think of it as being an exhaustive type of physically demanding sport, because you're just sitting on a motorcycle. And a lot of people can kind of relate and think, I ride a motorcycle. Like, I can go all day. I can do like 400 miles and I'm just a little saddle sore. On the racetrack, it just takes such concentration. You have to really focus on everything. And the last track day I did, that was on a Monday, and the weekend before, it was the Laguna Seca weekend. That weekend I went mountain biking with some friends of mine, and so we were mountain biking all weekend long. We were drinking way too much all weekend long. And on that Monday I went to the track, I was just exhausted from the weekend. And the thing I noticed right away is I just couldn't concentrate. I just couldn't stay focused. I was going down, and I'd see a plane. I'd be like, oh, look at that plane. And then I'd go see a corn worker. I'd be like, oh, look, it's a new corn worker. And every time I'm like, focus, focus. You got to stay focused on the track. And I was exhausted, so it kind of made sense that I just couldn't stay focused. But it's just a subtle thing. Like, towards the end of the day, you just start to get a little bit tired, and you lose your focus a little bit, and it doesn't take much more than that.
Right, right. And I mean, then let's not forget, the track day season is summertime. That was another problem that we had. It was hot that day. And, you've been outside. You're probably getting a little dehydrated, unless you're being very, very conscientious about drinking water and all of that. And you're wearing a leather suit, for crying out loud. All these things combine together to take it out of you. And it is. It's much more physically demanding.
Yeah. So a few tips for you, Bob. First of all, the one thing about a track day, and this is something I did in the very beginning, is, and I don't know if you do or don't do this, so it's more of a tip for you and your listeners. But you want to try to get prepared. You are going to do a track day on whatever day, so you don't want to go out drinking the night before and come into the track, still a little hungover. You want to try to get as much sleep as you can. If you're really serious and you're going to start being a club racer, then you probably want to start exercising at some other capacity, either walking or jogging or something else, just because it is such a physically demanding sport. And so you kind of want to think of those things through. And then when you get to the track on a track day, the one thing you want to do is you want to have something that you work on or practice every session. And so by the end of the day, you go out and you're like, okay, I have one thing I'm going to work on. I'm not going to worry about my drive out of turn 9 or anything else. I'm just going to work on, let's say, turn 4. That's all I'm going to work on. So the other turns, you just take less chances and less risk. You don't try to outbreak yourself into all those other turns. You're going to concentrate on just one thing. And so that helps you kind of stay focused, on that one part of the track, and it helps you in other areas because you're not trying to just push it everywhere.
And that makes a lot of sense. And you have said that to me on track days. But do you think that you're coming to this somewhat as the racer that goes to track days to improve his racing performance at that particular track, as opposed to, me, that is doing the track day, one, to just for fun, just because it is fun, and two, to maybe improve my street bike riding skills? So I'll admit I took your advice to heart, and I would try to have I want to work on this, but it tended to be a more vague this than, I'm going to work on turn 4. It would more along the lines of, I'm going to work on, across the whole track, not missing a shift or just keeping my corner speed up, these sorts of somewhat vaguer goals. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, it's you're right. I mean, everybody has different goals when they go to the track. Some people, you know, it's their first track day and they've only been riding a motorcycle for a year. You know, other people are racers and they're trying to, you know, go faster. And so you'll have a broad range of people at the track, and they have a broad range of goals and things that they want to accomplish during the day. Things being just, I want to have a fun time and I want to go fast, to other things being much more, you know, specific and detailed. So, but I think if you're going into the last session of the day, or every session you go into, you want to have something that you've thought about. The one thing that I don't like to do, and if just for myself personally, is I don't want to just go out there and turn laps. Because then I'm like, this is a pretty expensive day just to go ride circles around a racetrack. You know, I want to go out there and I want to say, okay, I want to work on something, and it doesn't have to be super specific. But I think as you progress along and as you start getting faster and faster, then in order to break through those little barriers that you come up against, you do need to get more specific. But when you're first starting off, you can be a little bit less specific because, you know, you're just trying to get some experience on the track.
And that makes a lot of sense. And for those of you out there, I mean, almost everybody that listens to this show has a motorcycle. That's judging from the email that I get and surveys that we did a couple years ago and all this sort of thing. But I think that a lot smaller percentage have done track days. And I do. I try to get all of my buddies and all of that. You got to do a track day. It's just awesome. I mean, and the thing is yes, you know, always the objection is the cost. You know, it's, you may not have all the equipment that you need and this sort of that. And, but I know that PSSR allows you, if you go out there and you ride in the C group, that you can use textile pants and stuff like that. So that the investment is minimal. You know, you probably already have this stuff that you need. And, you know, you just need to find a mentor. I would really recommend that. And, you know, and go out there and do it, because it's so much fun. And I've seen a very odd assortment of motorcycles at track days. So, you know, it's not like you have to have, you know, the R1 or whatever. You know, I've seen, V-Stroms. Right. I've seen KTM Supermotos. I mean, gosh, the sky's the limit. About the only thing I haven't seen actually doing a track day is a lot of cruisers. And I'm trying to think if I've even seen a cruiser out there.
I have actually seen in the last, well, since I've been in Portland, so the last 4 or 5 years, two guys come out on their Harley Sportsters, and they did a half-day track day. And they had a blast. You know, they were just doing their own thing. They came out and paid for half a day. And like you say, people, you know, the comments I get also, people don't, you know, they have a bike, but they don't want to do a track day. It's an intimidating thing. You know, it's like a racetrack. And so I try to tell them, I'm like, well, you go out to the, you know, up in the mountains and you go on the twisty roads and go for a ride on a Sunday, just go at that same perspective. I mean, it's just a tarred, you know, it's a asphalt road.
Except it's a lot safer.
Yeah, it's a lot safer. So, you know, if you just go out there and think, I don't need to go fast, I can just go as fast as I want to go, which might not be as fast as somebody else, you're having a fun time.
Right. And that's allowed. That's perfectly okay. I mean, if you're dangerously slow, you know, I've seen people get a talking to, then I've seen Fergus get a talking to for being too fast. But, more than once. But, you know, if you, yeah, you can go out there and it's not like you have to be keeping up. You know, as long as you're polite and listen to the rules about, you know, let the faster guys pass you, you'll be fine.
Right. The other thing I wanted to mention about another tip for you and your listeners is, if you're doing a track day and you crash, you have to get off. The first thing you want to do when you get back to the pits and you make sure you're safe and the bike is okay and you've got plans for the day, either you're going to try to fix the bike and go back out or not. But after that, you want to sit down and think about what just happened. You know, the factory riders and the MotoGP riders, they've got electronics all over the bike. So when they crash, they come back to the pits and they can analyze everything about that crash. They can see wheel spin, or, you know, when it was sliding, or they can, this is the rates on the suspension, and they can see, they can figure out exactly what caused them to have that wreck. And it makes it much easier to go back out the next time and go just as fast as you went before, because you know what happened in that last wreck, and you know how to either prevent it from happening in the future, or you know it was just an anomaly and it was, you know, kind of a fate thing, and so you don't need to worry about it. You can also kind of judge how fast you were going and previous laps in that same section of track, and you didn't crash then. So there's a whole analyzing process that you go through to figure out why you crashed. And as a track day person, you don't have all that information, but you can just kind of sit down and think, what was going on the track? What exactly was happening? What, you know, did the front end slide? Did the back end slide? And you really want to get as good of an understanding as you can over why you crashed. And then that just helps you the next time you go out, because you can say, okay, I know what happened last time. I know how to prevent it this next time, or I know how to avoid it, and you can kind of go at that rate. You talked last week about Jorge Lorenzo and how he's lost confidence because he's had all these crashes, and that's something that definitely can happen if you, you know, have these crashes, and then afterwards you're like, I don't understand why I crashed. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And I've almost gotten the impression that, you know, some of the Michelin riders, especially at Laguna Seca, were complaining about the Michelin tires and not giving them enough feel. And so that might have been something that, you know, he went back and looked at those charts and was like, I went exactly that same speed and that same, you know, section of the track earlier in the day and I had no problem, and now I do have a problem. And so maybe that's hurt his confidence, and that's something that's hard to get over. But, you know, that's something you want to do when you go down, is trying to think about what happened.
I think that, yeah, that makes good sense. And I kind of did just, you know, I'm not sure that you've given me that tip or not, but I try to do a little sort of a somewhat of a mental debrief after each session and figure out why, you know, I was comfortable or not comfortable in certain areas or what have you. I do know this, and this is one thing, and I said this before the season, that buying the specific track bike, and now we're getting to the expense of the whole thing, but that's helped me a lot. It really has. I was having a lot more fun out there on the SV650 for a variety of reasons, and not the least of which was that because it was race prepped. I bought a former racer and all of that, so it's got race body work. It's all safety wired. It's got rear sets. It's you know, it's pretty ugly. I mean, you've seen it, Darren. You know, all these sort of things. So basically, I'm a lot less worried about the motorcycle than I tend to be as the way I am. It's just unfortunate nature of my makeup that I just, you know, tend to worry about materialistic things, that I'm a lot less worried about the motorcycle being damaged. And because it's also somewhat, it's able to withstand at least a low side sort of a thing a little better than my street bike. Plus, the SV is a lot lighter and easier to move around on than the my FC1. So overall, I've really enjoyed the track days on the SV quite a bit more than even the FC1. And I've always had a good time with track days.
Yeah, and I think probably the progression you've made is the way a lot of track day people go, is they go out to the track on a bike they have, be it an FC1 or the Suzuki has their, what's the SV1000, or they've got some other big bikes that are basically like the Honda has the ST4, I think, which is kind of like a sport touring bike, which, you know, I've seen at the track before. They're fine. They're sport touring. I mean, there is a sport in the name. You can go fast on them. But, yeah, once people start going out there and then they start getting addicted, it's like, okay, I need to really get a bike that's meant for the track. And, you know, the SV650, I don't think comes off the showroom floor meant for the track, but it's raced by so many different people, and you can get them set up with a suspension set up that they do very good on the track. You know, they hold their own. They've got enough horsepower to get you down the front straight at a somewhat fairly, you know, fast speed, and they've got all the characteristics of a sports bike in the turn, so it makes them much easier to handle. They're much lighter, much easier to flick around, and, yeah, you can start enjoying that. And then, you know, as you go along, and my progression was, I was on a 650 for a few years, and then I was like, well, now I want a bigger bike, you know, I want to see what it's like. And so then I moved up, and, you know, myself personally, I go through bikes every few years anyway, so I don't like staying on the same thing. But, you know, the people that, I think that's a progression a lot of track day people to go, is they start off with riding with what they have and then kind of move into a better bike, better sport bike, maybe a track-specific bike.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. Well, all right. I think we kind of covered the points that we wanted to talk about. It's always fun having you on the show, Darren. I really appreciate your time on the phone and doing the call and all of that. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. And when is the next track day you're signed up for, Bob?
All right. The next track day I have in August. I'm going out middle of August on the 16th. I'm going to go and join up with Jan Dassa Dan Jassa, maybe, August 16th. And at Gateway in St. Louis. I'm really looking forward to that. It's a little nerve-wracking because, you know, they're kind enough to host me out there and all that, and we'll sort of see how I do. And then after that, I'm doing a track day up in Portland with you and Fergus on the 28th. So I've got, you know, a couple track days going on in August, and then I'm really looking forward to another trip to Thunder Hill, which is not till November this year. But
yeah, first week in November should be a fun time.
Yes, yes, indeed. It should be good times. So
tell your listeners if they want to join up with us to look up the PSSR website, they can join us at Thunder Hill.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you're in California and all that, and you're, or the Bay Area or anything, and you're relatively close to Thunder Hill, you know, don't worry about not being a PSSR regular. You know, we want you out there, and you're definitely welcome in our pits.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that particular date is like 95% of the people are all from Oregon or Washington, so it's like a big road trip for everybody, and it's a much more fun time. Everybody's down there having a blast and, you know, getting together at the restaurant after the track day and talking about how they were so fast.
Uh-huh, of course. Yeah, no, I'm definitely very much looking forward to that. So, right on. Well, we'll talk to you very, very soon, Darren, and I hope to have you on the show again before long. And again, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bob.
Right. Bye. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks very much for downloading it. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I enjoyed making it. It was good stuff. Thanks very much to Darren for being on the show. All right, next week we've got things a little bit different. I am taking the week off because I will be out of town. I'm going to St. Louis to join Dan Jassa and Anthony Dean and all the rest of the guys there at the Midwest Cafe Racing Association for their track day at the Gateway Raceway in St. Louis there. I'm really looking forward to that, doing that with the MCRA guys. So check out their website at mcraracing.com. Of course, there's a link on the website, including a couple other links, painterlens.com and all of those other sort of things. And so Jules is going to do a show next week. He's got some good stuff planned, and I'll let that be a big surprise. And I will talk to you all the following week. And until then, keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down, and we'll catch you on the other side. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.